last night. How's it work?
We're thinking about strange and barks and checkups. But this one is.
Do you have any theories?
I just remember. Apparently there's a new one there.
Lost my wallet. I flew in last night and I lost my wallet at the airport.
Ooh.
And I got it. But the United baggage claim people were not the most efficient.
Oh yeah.
I couldn't leave without it. So.
All right. So I think we're just going to kick things off. Hello everyone. My name is Sanjay Sarma. I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at MIT. Don't hold it against me. I'm also the vice president for open learning. And I'm going to talk a little bit, I was expected to talk about open learning, but I'll go fast and talk about something completely different. You know, the OER revolution is now 20 years old. It's been extraordinary. The implications of OER on the world are stunning. And I think it's widely accepted as a sort of a fundamental move made by humanity in terms of, especially in the knowledge economy. And I was in the room with Hal Abelson in 1999 when all this began to happen. I withdrew from OER because I had to get tenure. There's this little thing called tenure at MIT. But in 2012, I became the vice president for open learning and we started kicking things off. And this to me...
Because once you've got it.
Once I got it, I didn't give a damn. So what I'm going to talk we could do is maybe I think I speak for a few minutes and then Larry speaks for a few minutes and we just do a Q&A and kick things off. And it's really exciting to see this group meet and discuss, I think, profound issues facing this movement, but also, as I'll say, society going forward. You know, we are in a sort of a weird state right now around the world in terms of truth and knowledge and so on. And I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about it, and then I'll connect back to OER. So I asked my daughter, who's now 17 and a half, I said, where do you get your news from? And she says, the internet, blogs, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, and how do you know it's real? I asked her this 2 years ago, and asked her again this Sunday. And she goes, I triangulate. So I said, how do you triangulate? She says, well, I have my techniques. I triangulate. So it got me going a little bit. You know, I used to live in Hawaii a long time ago, and I was very curious about Polynesian history. And I began to think at that time, you know, how do the Polynesians find these islands? Where they came from, the Malaysia, Taiwan, etc. How did they find these islands and how did they navigate? It turns out the Polynesians have an extraordinary navigation system. But think about it. You're in the middle of the ocean, surfing the web, as it were, right? It's dark. You have no idea which way you're pointing. How do you navigate from one island to another, from, say, Hawaii to Tonga, right? It's quite extraordinary. It's one of those amazing human achievements. Now, that's sort of where we are, I think, as we navigate. You know, we're all land lovers, and we find ourselves at sea when it comes to the information revolution. And we don't have navigation tools, really don't. And what happens often is that we look around, we see another boat, or in the case of the Polynesians, another catamaran, and you go, I guess I'm heading in the right direction because you're there, right? We sort of triangulate off each other. But we could both be equally wrong. And in fact, we could be going in circles. And that's sort of what's happened in social media. In fact, there's a great paper written by one of my colleagues, actually a few of my colleagues, called Me, My Echo Chamber and I. Social media, introspection and social media polarization. And essentially what happens is these groups of catamarans form their own version of the truth. They go around circles. They triangulate off each other, but they're all drifting. And this is sort of where the world is right now, you know, social media polarization. There are landmarks. We just haven't trained people to recognize them, to navigate, to figure out if they're going the wrong direction. The landmarks are, you know, Wikipedia, OpenCourseWare, which I'm very proud of. You know, Kathy, you played a central part in it. And as we sort of get together here to talk about all this stuff, I think it's important for us to not just make these things we think about as an oh, by the way, but to make them central in our education of ourselves and of younger people who are actually more savvy than us, but still we haven't given them techniques, tools, et cetera, et cetera. And when my daughter says she's triangulates, she's making up navigation tools. Triangulation, in fact, is a navigation technique. The Polynesians are quite amazing, by the way. They had their own navigational tools. They had something equivalent to the sextant, not really, but sort of, astrolabes. They could, if you couldn't see the stars, if it was the day, they could navigate by the sun. If you couldn't see the stars, or if it was cloudy, they could navigate by birds, bird flight. The plover was special, the seagull was special. And if none of the above, you had none of the above, they could navigate by wave patterns. And they had these little stick drawings where you could sort of look at the wave patterns and figure out, you know, whether you're heading this way or that way. It's quite amazing. It's something we need to, I mean, if you're interested, it's worth reading about. But I think we need to sort of start thinking of knowledge as we acquire it from the internet and from other sources, not as information, but we've got to start thinking about as information structures. And so what does that mean? Well, information structures, and as an academic, two academics here, many academics here, I think of information that I get from academic papers based on citations, and it's a structure. You know, I know the seminal work in it. I know the assumptions the seminal work was based on. And when I look at a piece of work, I know, you know, the provenance of the information as it's sort of built to that conclusion, right? And I can go question every little experiment. Sometimes the experiments are wrong and that whole structure collapses. And I think we have to build into our instinct a way to build these structures of knowledge. Citations is just one example. We also have instincts. And there are, you know, even other things like, we know people, you know, labs, you know, trustworthy sources, right? It's like it's like the navigational tools that Polynesians have. And we also need engines to digest a truth. There have been attempts in the past. For example, there was the NewsGuard thing that Stephen Bill
and co-built, which sort of didn't work. Microsoft had a little plugin where you could look at the news and it tell you if news is right. We also need to understand the neuroscience of truth, how we fall for, you know, into traps, how we spiral into traps of belief. You know, why video is so evocative, which brings us to what Fran showed you last night, and we're going to do a retelling of, reshowing of that today. Fran, whom I'll introduce a little bit later, is our creative director in the Center of Advanced Virtuality at MIT. And one of the things that Fran and her colleague, Fox Harrell, are talking about is virtual truth, which is this ecosystem of catamarans that believe each other, right? They have their own world belief system, but they're drifting completely untethered to the reality of where they are, right? But the bedrock of all this, truly, to me, is knowledge and the landmarks. And as we landlubbers sometimes drift around in the sea, I think that we need to really figure out where the lighthouses are, you know, the features, the land features that we can recognize, you know, whether it's Mauna Loa, which you can see from this far away, or Mauna Kea. We need to figure out what the logic is for constructing, you know, your location. I can see Mauna Loa there, and I can see Haleakala there, and therefore must be here, and the sun's over there, it's east. What is the logic? We need to develop an instinct for basically something like citations. Keep in mind that Google is based on citations. The Google search algorithm is a citation index. I was getting my PhD at UC Berkeley. I used to know Sergey Brin, and I remember him talking about the citation index, right? It's the thing that unleashed the web. So maybe we need some way to build in knowledge, provenance, and citation indices into everyone's thinking, you know? But the bedrock in the end is going to be fact bases. And in that, I think what we've done is, what we've achieved in the OER community is absolutely tremendous. And, you know, I was talking to Jamie about extending what Wikipedia does, you know, all the OER resources around the world, also even websites like Snopes. I don't know if you've checked out Snopes, it's actually surprisingly good. So this is all a way of saying that to me, OER is a bedrock, but on that we need to build a new habit of the mind. We have to equip young people, ourselves, none of you is young, by the way, ourselves, to navigate this space and think about information and its provenance every day with everything. If you haven't seen the Pelosi speech, cheap fake, right? That had its own little gravitational ecosystem recently, and this is the world we all confront. So I told you I would barely talk about open educational resources. I think I barely spoke about it, but I do hope that we think of it with renewed urgency in the 21st century. So with that, I also want to just say thank you to Angela, to Peter, and to everyone else who helped organize this. And Kurt, thank you for that, for pulling all this together. Yvonne on the other side. But it's a real pleasure to be here. Gary.
Thank you. I'll also start with thanks to actually all of you for coming and helping us figure out how to do this better. But I think I'm also not going to talk about OER directly, at least very much at all. Although, and I'm not even supposed to talk about what Sanjay just talked about, although I'm going to talk about it a little because it's part of the same thing and because I can't resist. And because I'm actually teaching a course on this with Josh Cohn, former colleague at Apple University, but on democracy and speech in the digital age. And actually just finished a breakfast yesterday with Larry Lessig talking about exactly this set of issues, because they are critical. But here's how the central orientation at Hewlett around the broad set of issues is what are the conditions necessary for popular government, for democratic government? And I actually prefer the word popular because democracy is so loaded and hard to know, but essentially a system of government in which the government can govern reasonably well in response to what the community expresses as what it wants and needs. And there's sort of three pieces to that that have emerged here over the years. The central piece where we started a few years ago, we called the Madison Initiative, and it was really focused around the notion that the first condition is you need political institutions that are capable of achieving compromise. Because any democratic, any society at this point, there's no such thing as a homogeneous society. So there's going to be disagreements, and there's going to be people with very different beliefs and passions and desires for what you should do. And so there's no way to govern in anything like a democracy that doesn't centrally involve accommodation across those differences. And, you know, we had political institutions that were capable of doing that, and for various reasons, the capacity to do that has clearly broken down, and what can we do to restore that? So that's piece one. And that's where we started. And, you know, when I got here in 2012, I wrote the board a memo saying we needed to work on this, and here's why. And if we didn't do it sometime within the next 30 years, you could expect the election of a demagogue, and because that's what history taught us. And it took 4 years, right? Because that was 2012. And in 2016, that's, you know, wherever you stand on the pod, it's hard not to look at that and say that's President Trump is your classic kind of demagogue. And so the question was, well, why did that happen so much faster? What was it about us that we came up with two things. So one was that the information environment is so bad, so that even if you could imagine, even if your political institutions were capable of achieving reasonable compromises that might actually advance the welfare of the community as a whole, if what people are being told or believe and are hearing is something different, that this is horrible, that these are traitors, that this was enacted by your enemies, it's not gonna work. So you have to fix that information environment and get people back into a place where at least they are being reasonably well informed in ways that are tethered to reality and that are roughly in the same ballpark, whereas we just don't have that at all. And how to address that, as I say, I have ideas on that. I'd love to talk about that, but let's put that aside. Now, the other piece was, even if you have institutions that are capable of achieving compromise, and even if you have a public that's being reasonably well informed about what the government's doing and what its actual consequences are, there needs to be an ideas framework within which there's room for reasonable, constructive disagreement. And that also we don't have any longer, so that the two parties, they can't even talk to each other on substance. There's so little, and why was that? And so that's this rethinking political economy work. And so I'll talk most about that, because I think that's what Angela wanted. So let me just frame that for you. And I do it, I will say, against the background lately of some discomfort with the state of philanthropy and, in some sense, the nonprofit world, which is, I realize, it is a fundamentally anti-intellectual community. What I mean by anti-intellectual in this sense, because nobody in it thinks that they're anti-intellectual, but what I mean is it is a community that really does not have a whole lot of faith in the importance of ideas and in the fact that ideas are action. So now people don't think that, but you know, when I look at them, the people we're talking to, sort of, they look at evidence and they're behind the policies that they want to push, and what they're interested is in pushing the policies without recognizing that those ideas and those policies are themselves grounded in a much larger framework, and that larger framework is hugely important to the capacity both to think of ideas down there at the level of policy and to actually move them forward. So that was, so the framework that we started with is one in which, at any given point in time, I'll do it the way. At any given point in time, there is an overarching intellectual paradigm of some. There's actually multiple paradigms. There's a democracy paradigm. There was a point in time when people thought the king is divine. They actually believed that. Now, not that they thought the king was literally divine, but it stood for a set of principles that helped them organize their world in which power could be exercised by the crown without question in certain ways. And that was ultimately replaced by some notion that the people have a voice, right? And once you move from the king is divine to the people have a voice, your acceptance of things that the crown might do is going to be radically changed. You might still allow it because the ultimate decision about whether you favor or don't favor something is influenced by a multiplicity of factors, but that big background belief plays a critical role, puts a thumb on the scale in favor of some things and against others. And that at any given point in time, there's always some such prevailing story that is shaping the way people are responding, and the disagreements take place within it. So there is also one around how we think about government, the role of government, society, the economy, all of that. And again, just quickly, in the 90s, and these evolve over time because they're not right or wrong, they're explanations that people use to make sense of the world. And the explanations run a gamut. So there's a big, broad background story that, like, my mother needs to understand, that ordinary citizens need to grasp. It's usually, and that story has to be logically connected to a set of ideas that get more and more complicated because, you know, down here, the people who are making complex policy over complex issues have to act, and they have to act in ways that are consistent with the larger story, that nevertheless produce outcomes that actually are perceived as beneficial and so reinforce the larger story. So in the 19th century, in the laissez-faire displaces mercantilism from the 18th century, partly because you have a, you know, the economic and social conditions are, it's wide open, westward expansion in America, west here, colonization in Europe, and they don't need government, right? There's nothing government can do that helps them. And so a story that really leaves space for people to just go do what they want to do kind of makes sense. By the late 19th century, that's just not true anymore. The economy has changed. A communications revolution, transportation revolution, second industrial revolutions, people are urbanizing, they're working in factories, they're dying in droves, and there's a perceived need for government regulation. Even so, the stickiness of that laissez-faire story, the stickiness of any prevailing paradigm, because it's grounded in culture and it's grounded in institutions after a point in time, is such that it takes a lot to move it, and it really takes the shocks of World War I and the Great Depression to actually get people to abandon it. And what happens when people abandon, when the explanation that they have been using stops working, is you have a period of dislocation, not surprisingly, and people will drift towards what seems to them the next best explanation. And in the 1920s and 30s, there were a bunch of them floating around. There always are. There was communism. A lot of people thought, yes, that makes more sense to us than this laissez-faire capitalist thing, which is just like awful. There was fascism. Some people went in that direction. And, you know, in the West, complicated story, but ultimately what really took was Keynesianism, which is the smallest possible modification of free market capitalism, but a really significant one in terms of what it enabled government to do. Government can manage those markets and takes some time. It gets established after World War II, and once again, you have a whole set of institutions that are built to reinforce that story, which works for people, until you have another dislocation in the late 60s, early 70s. And again, it's caused by the same kinds of things, right? Which is changes in the economy, changes in the culture. That managed market stuff isn't working for anybody. You have high interest rates, high inflation, stagflation, oil shocks. You know, you've got the idea of government management has spread from the economy to everything. So they're managing the environment, and they're managing race relations, and they're managing family. Society feels like it's coming apart at the seams. And so people drift again. And at that point in time, you have, you know, Milton Friedman and what we now call neoliberals standing there going, yes, the problem is too much government. It's not laissez-faire. Government actually needs to construct, manage, and protect markets, but they need to be these wide open free markets. And there's a whole story behind that, and it takes, and that's what we've been living with since. And again, the idea is just, it's an explanation that works better for people than what they've had. So the point is we're at another one of those inflection points. Right? The economy has changed significantly. Neoliberalism as a solution, which did seem to work for people for the problems as they were experiencing them in the 70s and 80s, is now the source of a different set of problems because of changes in the economy. It has generated a massive amount of wealth inequality that at this point is so stark that it's causing all sorts of social tensions. We've had this massive change in the structure of labor markets, and unions no longer work, but we haven't replaced them with anything else. And technology and automation and machine learning and AI are causing huge dislocations, and we don't have any way to thoughtfully regulate them. Instead, just jobs seem to be disappearing, but people are afraid of that. And we created this international trade system, which was fantastic for hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, but it has had a set of side effects, particularly in the established economies of the West, that it hasn't been able to deal with. And all of this is creating problems, and people are drifting. And they're drifting towards the next best explanation, which for better or worse is people are calling it populism. I hate that word, because all populism means is rejection of elites. Question is for what? So this is really, I think the best way, it's ethno-nationalism. And that's true, that's Trump, but it's not just in the US, that's what's going on in Hungary and in Poland and in Israel and in India. All the place in South America and all the place in the world, people see this world dislocated. The next best explanation they've been offered is it's those people out there and these global elites, they're causing all this problem in your life. And we just need, and that's making more sense to people because we haven't given them anything else. Mm-hmm. So we have to find a way to develop a framework that fits that notion that's a simple enough story that my mom can grasp it, but that is logically connected so that we can develop policy solutions to the problems that are existing in ways that reinforce the story. We have lots of policy solutions. Some of them might even be good, but they're not connected to anything. And so they're not sticking for people. Even if you can succeed on the Affordable Care Act for like 10 minutes, but it's not grounded in something deep in the public. And so it barely holds on. And a lot of other policies actually can just get overturned in the next election. And so it's that broader story that needs to be quite different that we're thinking about. And I can talk a lot about how we're thinking about it, but let me stop that's there and just.
That's an incredible arc. I love the way you think.
You covered it all.
How do you think technology plays into that? Just a quick question.
So on the one hand, obviously technology is a big source of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
Both on the speech side, obviously it's huge, but also in terms of what it's doing to the structure of the economy. My view is fundamentally, especially on issues like these, technology doesn't change people. People change technology. Mm-hmm. So I don't actually think that, one of the lessons of history was direct democracy is a really bad idea. And yet there's all these people out there who think we can use technology to create a more direct democracy where millions of people can immediately express their views to policymakers and lawmakers. And it's like, oh, that's like such a bad idea. Why would you think that something that wouldn't work with people who are face to face and know each other is going to work with millions of people who don't know each other? And in fact, I think the answer is technology is a tool. We need to be thoughtful about how we use it. It can be used for good or for ill, but it inherently, other than as a disruptor that requires us to rethink things, doesn't fundamentally change the structure of the problems.
But what about knowledge? I mean, you need to understand neoliberalism. You need to understand what the implications are, what's wrong with it. What's neoliberalism, sort of more liberal neoliberalism is to more, Clinton versus Obama, right? I mean,
yeah.
Isn't that important? I mean, you're trying, if people have to understand something, it doesn't stick, right? How do you make it stick?
Well, so again, here I'm going to say things that are, I don't know if unpopular is quite the right word, but contrary to the kinds of things you're supposed to say. So obviously knowledge is pivotal, but informing people is not going to solve our problems. You know, Madison has this great line in Federalist 51 that if every Athenian was a Socrates, every Athenian assembly would still have been a mob. And I think that's absolutely right. So what we need to do is be able to step back and understand what were the structure of the institutions that made it possible. So that was not simple oligarchy, but that was also not direct democracy. So how do we have this mediated system in which there's a role for leadership, but in which we don't expect every citizen to actually have solid fixed views on everything we do that they express in some notion that people are just going to execute those like ciphers, that there's a role for leadership. To me, as much as it's restructuring, because what technology has done in the short run actually is create a massive democratization of information, which is potentially good, but not until we figure out how to restore the mediating function, and it's the lack of mediation that's creating all the problems.
So, Peter, what do we do next? Just to open discussion? Questions?
Yeah. I think that's the plan. And at some point soon, we're going to get a chance to see, backed by popular demand, Fran's 7.5-minute film on these topics.
So, questions, discussion, disagreements, disputations?
I have a question, which is, we were given the opportunity to read your new memo. Maybe it was an assignment. I don't know how it was presented to us. But we were granted the chance.
Draft strategy hasn't been seen by the board yet. Just so you know.
And it's just, at the same time, yesterday we were talking, the OER movement is hitting its sort of 20th year. And we're thinking about OCWs, about turning 20 next year. Thinking about how to direct some of the energy that's here. And one question is there a way to direct, there's a lot of energy, the energy in the OER movement and all of its supporters and all of its, to achieve some of the objectives around building a new kind of common sense, as you talk about it in the paper, I mean, one thing that the, and I'll end the question, one thing that the Montfellerin Society never had was the internet. And this group, people from MIT and Wikipedia and Delft and College of the Canyons and Berkeley and Internet Archive is pretty skilled at, we're educators and skilled at technology and education and so, and publishing. So I wonder, like, as we think of the next 20 years, is there a way to, do that thing for you, for this vision, for the vision that you both articulated?
Well, although, so first, I think the stronger place where OER plays is in the set of issues that Sanjay was talking about. And so how are we going to solve that? But I think, we have been thinking about this. So in our piece, I started thinking about this problem. There were a bunch of causes, but one of them was in the 2016 election, Paul Ryan gave a talk in his home district. It didn't get much coverage. I happened to see it, in which he described the world as Hillary, if Hillary won, what the world would look like. And I'm paraphrasing, but not caricaturing. When he said that your lives will be gray, crushed by the sameness of the collectivity. And when I listened to it, I thought, God, that's so embarrassing for him. It's like Ayn Rand, you know, so and since it's like second rate Ayn Rand, that makes it like fourth rate thinking. And then I realized, but of course, when he was a young man in his early 20s, you've heard this story, I think. When he was a young man in his early 20s at St. Olaf's College, this is what he was taught. Mm-hmm. And that's just true for all of us, right? That's the real period when the vast majority of people get their core ideas and commitments shaped, and we seldom radically change them after that. And so education is absolutely key. The thought was, God, we need the next generation of leaders to have a better sense of the world and a better set of ideas from which they're gonna build. And so education becomes key. It's really hard to break through. And think about economics, for instance. There was a way economics has been taught which, without even being intentional, reinforces a set of ideas that are really hard to dig people out of. And so how do you disrupt the education system, which is textbook-based? You know, this is key. So we're working, for instance, how many of you are familiar with CORE? Which is it's a new economics. We're actually struggling with them a little. They don't want to be as open as we think they should be, but it is online and it will be free. But they really want to control their content a little more than was, you know, not really appreciating the power that will come from letting faculty do what you can do with OER. But it's a way to get past the kind of Samuelson-Mankow lock on how economics is taught everywhere. So the disruptive capacity of OER in terms of changing teaching, which we're going to have to do really broadly, I think is important for pushing any new set of ideas.
So let's go with Dinah, then Kurt, and then Al.
I'm thinking about what you said in relation to our role in higher education, and particularly, Larry, what you just said in terms of how we learn, what we learn, at what age do we get kind of set in our ways. And in our current environment, and with Sanjay's daughter as an example, not to pick on her.
I have a 19-year-old,
make it 32.
but you know, what we're thinking, what we are struggling with, or what I am struggling with in particular, is this kind of notion that we're getting pressure to educate and inform our students. We have a mission of access, but preparing them with skills for the workforce. So there's pressure to do that. And on the other hand, what I'm hearing, and I think what all of us believe, is there is, you know, this notion of liberal arts education, and then there's this notion of all this information, the how do you filter, how do you triangulate the news? And I feel like we have a role to, if we can, I can't even do it for myself, so I don't know that I can do it for my students, for our students, but that balance between learning how to learn and learning what to learn and learning what you need to learn in order to try to get at some of these goals that you're expressing.
No, it's a great question. Actually, if I may, I'm going to add to the question.
I thought you were going to answer.
No, I'm not going to answer.
I thought it was confusing enough. You're going to add
to it. Great, no, it's a great question. I think actually this is a great time, a great danger to liberal arts education, because we're caught in two worlds. On the one hand, we want to think deep thoughts and so on. On the other hand, we want to teach everyone AI so they can get a job tomorrow because college tuition is so high, right? It's all about the work of the future and so on. And I think the liberal arts could get crushed. Now, there's some aspects of liberal arts, I think, that need to be rethought, right? I don't want to restate the book, you know, Pedagogy of the Oppressed and things like that. But there are, you know, you saw what happened in the Yale class on art appreciation, right? Whatever which class it was. But it doesn't mean that we crush it all. But I worry that in our utilitarian rush, we're going to end up there. Up to get your opinion on that.
Oh, gosh. So I have so many thoughts on this, although many of them are sort of broader. You know, first, I you know, we're in a period of particular insanity all around, where a lot of things that have good and proper problems with good and proper motivations have been pushed and taken in directions that are just insane, layered on top of a particularly intolerant culture for argument. So it's hard to push forward on much of anything right now. I mean, I'm old enough. Some of you probably are too. We've been through this before. The 60s had a wave like this. The 80s, early 90s had a wave like this. We'll get through that, I think. Hopefully a little better, and then really have maybe recreated some better space to make progress. So I just want to flag that. You know, I think, you know, the other side of our education strategy, of which this will hopefully be folding into, is really addressed to some extent to that problem. So, you know, we have to recognize, one, lifelong learning is the way to think about it completely. So we have to get away from the notion that we have to give everybody everything they need for education in this short period of time, and then think, so what are the fundamental pieces? So what I love about the whole deeper learning concept is it's really a capacity for lifelong learning. It's learning how to learn, which is going to be critical. And OER is huge for that, in my view, because the ability of letting students participate in the creation of the course itself is just a fantastically empowering thing for them. So that's one. Two, in terms of, you know, content, as I said, the idea of these competencies, of which learning to learn is one, but, you know, those are going to serve whatever career aspirations we have. We do need to dial back generally the notion that the main purpose of high school and college education is preparing you for a career as opposed to preparing you for citizenship, which includes the capacity for a career. But I think that shift needs to be pushed back. I think the liberal arts are on life support at this point, partly for that reason, partly because we've lost the sense of being able to explain to people why they're important to them. I mean, it has bothered me. When I came here, I was toying with the idea of, did I want to go down the path to try and become a university president? And in some ways, the attraction of that in my mind was because over the last 30 years, my entire career, I cannot think of a single university president anywhere who has stood up publicly for the liberal arts, who has stood up publicly for education. And so there's been this 30-year attack on it that has worked because we never pushed back in any way, which has invalidated a huge amount of misinformation around the cost problem, in fact, what it actually is and how it actually works, and what benefits people again. So we need a whole lot of that pushing back to deal with it. So as I say, a lot of it is getting rid of the notion that these are two things in opposition and we better choose career preparation because this is really expensive, and getting back to rethinking what it is we're preparing people for, grounded in a real sense of what it does. I mean, I can't say more than that in very general terms. I think OER has a really important role, though, in what is a key part of the educational piece, precisely because of the way in which it empowers students to educate themselves and learn how to do that.
And if I could just say one other thing, then we'll go to the panel. I think we need to understand the neuroscience of our neuroscience, the human brain. Have you folks heard of the Hubel Weasel experiment, the Nobel laureates? They raise kittens, it seems a little cruel actually, in a room with pajama, vertical pajama stripes, right?
and then they release them into the wild, and the kittens can't jump onto things like tables because they have horizontal features. They are not trained to see them. And so that's number one. And number two is, this is a disturbing find by one of my colleagues, John Gabrielli. Our children, the children in this room, compared to the child of a blue-collar worker, frankly, who works maybe two jobs, doesn't get to spend a lot of time with their child. By age three, you can see the difference, the physical differences in the brain in an MRI. So I also want to say that it actually starts very young, fortunately. So those are my two little disturbing thoughts.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And thank you for inviting us to participate in this conversation. Larry, I read your paper with great interest, and I found a lot to agree with in it. But my comments are not going to focus on that for reasons of unnecessary sycophancy, and also because as much as I found to agree with it, there were a couple of points of it that jumped out at me as being personally disturbing. And I wanted to share those with you in hopes, as honestly as I could, in hopes that it might be useful as you think about how to finalize it. And one of them was the absence of any reference to our community. As you were postulating potential avenues to solve the question of how we developed popular understanding and support for a framework that would supplant the neoliberal mechanisms that have proven so problematic. And I guess the part of it that
which community?
Yeah. The OER community.
Okay.
And the part of it that stuck in my craw so deeply is my sense, at least, that the OER community is itself a living refutation of the neoliberal paradigm. What we have in the OER community is a group of people who looked at the exact same tools that the Silicon Valley winner-take-all neoliberal elite focused on to create this massive, unprecedented income inequality that we exist with right now. And we as a community have said, we can take those same technologies and those same tools, and with a different intentionality, we can use them to create a more fair society, a more equitable society, a society where the opportunities that are available are more fairly distributed by the choices we make about. So we are ourselves what you're asking for in the paper. And what's more, we have now organized thousands of academics and others by discipline all around the world who are engaged in constructing exactly the kind of successor to neoliberalism that your paper calls for. And in every one of these communities, it's my sense from having been so deeply in these waters for so long, that for many of us, the OER, the fact that we focused on education and open educational resources, was because we wanted to make educational resources available more ubiquitously and at higher levels of transparent quality. But also, in some sense, the medium was the message. A lot of us always hope that when we educate the next generation of students using these open resources, and they see the advantages that accrue from this approach to the use of technology, that as they proceeded in their academic careers and in their lives, they would begin to question other inappropriate uses of technology and begin to wonder why there wasn't open solutions to municipal infrastructure, why there isn't open solutions to a myriad of finance and a myriad of pressure points that are used right now to enforce the neoliberal economic order. So I kept turning the pages of your paper thinking, he's going to get to us. He's going to say where we come in. Because we're already the troops on the ground that are doing this work on every corner of the earth. And I kept turning the page and turning the page and didn't find us in there. So my appeal to you is to think through who we are and what we've already accomplished and the communities that we've already organized that are doing the work you call for in the paper, and work with us to harness the capacities that our community represents in order to develop the alternative set of practices around which a general theory can be built. That's point one. And again, pardon me. Like I said, there's a lot I agree with in your paper.
Okay,
we can talk about that later. And the other part of it is, and this is just, you know, my personal perception of it, but I got the sense from reading it that, you know, Milton Friedman came along and he defined this, you know, goofy set of economic principles. And from that, the dismantling of the American working class followed. And my personal experience, I raised in a family, I grew up in welfare and food stamps and, you know, out of high school at age 15 to work, was that the destruction of the American middle class was well underway long before Friedman came along. And that what he and the theorists over neoliberal economic theory did is they created a framework where when unions were being destroyed and the powers of workers were being destroyed and the family was under assault by the economic disintegration of the single parent, of the single earner family and all of the consequences of that, they then created after the fact a framework that could be used to convince government not to intercede, not to prevent these. But, you know, the robber barons were robber baroning long before, you know, the bullies, the economic bullies were oppressing people long before the economic theorists came around to apologize for it and to say, well, you know, that's actually, you know, in the natural order of things. And that the more productive work today could be done by getting close to groups like the Platform Cooperative Consortium, a group that I've been trying to help me to get off the ground for some time, that are actually in the workplace organizing workers to own their own platforms from which they benefit and where they're not, where the fruits of their labor are not extracted by some third party, and that the theory that envelops those new forms of worker organizing won't come before that, before the action on the ground. That the action on the ground actually is what needs to be supported first by supporting these at-risk workers that the new forms of labor organizing are actively engaged in.
Okay.
So those were my two main critiques, and thank you for tolerating this. So,
sure, no. So on the first one, fair point, I take it. I got the same criticism from the performing arts people who are like, there are tons of artists groups and colonies that have worked out different economic models that are doing what you are saying and so on. The short answer to that is all fair, and actually when we do the actual work, we do plan. We are already doing it. I hadn't thought about OER, I confess, but like we've supported a number of grantees who are looking at performing arts solutions that have been developed, because if you think about it, artists really have been, they've been in what we think of as, let's say, the modern gig economy. They've been doing that forever, right, since the mid-20th century and so on. So there's a lot. So we do think we need to and plan to learn. The paper wasn't about that. It's just not at that level or that level of detail. It's actually explaining something different. So it's trying to explain to the board, think about, and then this will lead into the answer to the second point, which is, so here's the neoliberal framework, right? Society, it's a conceptual, it's a set of ideas. Society consists of atomized individuals who are pursuing their own self-interest. We used to say rationally pursuing their own self-interest. We've now come to qualify that. But nevertheless, that the structure of society is individuals, that they are pursuing their own interests, and that is the definition of liberty. And then at the other end, that the goal of the society as a whole is to maximize wealth generation. And that from those, all these principles follow. So the quest, that is a totally coherent story that drives all sorts of stuff that when you look at things that are happening on the ground, make some things seem, yes, I'll support that. And other things, no, that doesn't seem right to me. Things that I might support because of that, I might still be persuaded for other reasons because life is complicated, I shouldn't. Things that are against it, I might still be persuaded to support that way, but it's a big thumb on the scale. And we need a different story. We need a different conception of society, a different conception of our goal. We need to link that and with the kinds of things it creates, and we need to make that, so that's what that's about. That's just why the paper doesn't focus on those small experiments. Now,
that said, it leads to the answer to your second thing, which is, as I say, fundamentally, so I believe two things. So first, actually descriptively, what you said is not quite right. There have always been, there was always the fight. So of course there were conservative forces that were fighting against the liberal solutions of the 50s and 60s. They had the uphill fight then. They couldn't get very much done, right? They did some, all of the data shows that there is a sea change that takes place in the mid 70s and in particular after 1980, because at that time, all of the kinds of solutions that they had been pushing for, because of this change in the background intellectual environment, become way easier to sell. And as they become easier to sell, all those things actually happen, which to me is my point exactly. So if you're only looking at, I have an idea, look, I can show you the numbers, it's helping these people. If it's contrary to the that background sort of set of philosophy, paradigm, whatever it is, it's harder to make work. And if it's a question of whether it's a tailwind or a headwind, right? And so what had been a headwind turns into a tailwind and things change dramatically after that. So that's really our point. And as I say, I think you do, we plan to, as you see in the paper, work with all of those, learn from, but you don't generate theory that way. And those are not the people who generate the theory. So you have to be working all along the continuum as well. What we find in philanthropy now is that 99% of it is down there. None of it is over here. And it's really been difficult trying to persuade funders to see the relevance. That's what I mean when I say the philanthropy world is fundamentally anti-intellectual. All they believe is, I've looked at the data. I know what I think is the right solution. I just need to put more money behind it and get my movement people going, and we'll get it done. Then we're going to sit there and we're going to slug it out forever. Right? Even as we lose over and over again or get these Pyrrhic victories that get overturned quickly, that to me it's so obvious because you're fighting an uphill battle. So as I say, I think we need to, because it has to be the coherence has to run all the way down. So of course there's a lot to learn, but we need to be working at the other place where there's just nobody doing it right now. The last thing to remember is when you do develop that new framework, it's going to create space for people to think of things that they haven't thought of yet. So it's not in the paper you guys saw in the first paper that I did for the board. I pointed out to them, the neoliberal movement is kicked off in 1943 when Hayek publishes The Road to Serfdom. And when he publishes that book, the reviews at the time are like, this is this reactionary right-wing screed. It's extreme. If you actually read it today, it's like a half an inch to the right of the New Deal. Filled with social welfare programs, it embraces most of what the New Dealers were after. By 1962, when Milton Friedman publishes Freedom and Democracy, like there are ideas there that he's pushing that were not imaginable in 1943 yet, because these paradigms also change the space within which we can imagine things. And so that's why you need to. So as I say, I don't disagree with anything, just we're working at a different point for the most part. And trying to create links.
Well, I guess the last, I'm all for anything that turns our headwind into a tailwind, and that makes a lot of sense to me. Just please don't overlook the progress that the OER community has made in organizing already around the world in many centers of academic interest alternatives to the neoliberal paradigm. We're already there.
So. Peter, how much are we doing for time?
We have half an hour.
Okay, so Kurt and then Claudio. Okay.
I don't think that's what it's kind of reflecting on, Sanjay, you raised the point of neuropsychology. We're confronted again and again by more research about how fundamental our sort of tribal affiliation is and our ability to take in information, and how over time, more recently, those affiliations are getting more stacked. They used to be more distributed, and thus create openings to, get information and get knowledge to people in more flexible ways. This is perhaps more of a kind of near-term tactical thing. If we see that that's really happening, to what extent is the work that we've been doing a much better fit for some tribal affiliations than others, and what can we do to break out of that?
But I'll just give a quick sort of my perspective on it. So the system one, system two thinking, reflex versus deep thinking. A lot of interesting work on that. Kahneman got the Nobel Prize for talking about it.
And I think that a lot of the news cycles focus on the number one. And then you go into this sort of loop, right? And you read another blog, and the whole thoughtful stuff goes away. By the way, I like to get my news from the Wikipedia news page because it's thoughtful. I was talking to someone from The Economist, and they were really slow in going online. And apparently that's the best thing that happened. And I said, why? This is actually by, there's a book about many of these topics, Bharat Anand, that Arvind. And actually he explained to me why. Apparently, the fact that they were slow, it protected them from the tendency to get into the fast news cycle, because the whole point of The Economist is to provide digested news. If they'd gotten into the whole web page, keep it fresh, you know, race with CNN, Fox, it would have taken them away from this. So one of my points here, just a simple point, is that I think knowledge structures, information structures need to anneal and work out. And we've sort of fallen into a trap. We wouldn't let that happen. It plays into the emotion, into the hypothalamus, which is where emotions are generated. And I think that's one big aspect of it. And thoughtfulness is gone. So this is my quick response. Claudia.
As I listen to all of this conversation, I wonder whether we are missing a big point, which is the fact that perhaps the new paradigm is in fact what you, Larry, called ethnic nationalism in response to neoliberalism. There is nothing neoliberal in how the trade policies of this administration in this country or the governments, the far-right governments in Europe are developing their societies. They're a very different set of actions at work. But it seems to me we are coming at the end. We're seeing things in a very myopic way. We are in the Saul Steinberg, 9th Avenue, looking at 10th Avenue, missing the Hudson River and what's beyond that. We are coming at the end of 300 years of massive improvements in productivity in human life. We increase lifespan, we live in living conditions which are amazingly better, that are unrecognizable in terms of material welfare for people who lived 50 or 100 years ago. That process is ending. There's a lot of work that's been done by Robert Gordon at Northwestern around the decline in productivity rates and the underlying physical causes. And this was captured very well by Martin Wolf at the FT when he said, if you ask me whether I should give up some of the progress that was achieved at 50 and 100 years ago, if you ask me whether I want to give up indoor plumbing or the social network, I know which one I'll give up first. A lot of the ethnic nationalism seems to be a response to this decline in productivity growth. It's the fact that for the first time, not only the living people cannot any longer think that the conditions of their children will be any better, they don't think their conditions will be better even in their lifetime than they've been in the past. And it's so we are barking at the wrong tree. We're worrying about neoliberalism when the problem is not neoliberalism at all. It's the fact that we're bumping against a set of physical limitations. We may be myopic. There may be some fantastic scientific revolution around the corner that will change that, but right now we are bumping against declines in productivity growth that are affecting the welfare of everybody. We're bumping against aging populations, and people are responding to this with tribalism, fundamentally, because it's something they can hold on to. And if that's a new paradigm, we are having a conversation around how we develop a new one, when in fact, a much bigger new paradigm, which appeals to lots of people. It appeals to 50% of people in every country, in the West, easily, and perhaps more. That is the new paradigm. That's what's happening.
Yeah, so let me answer two ways. So the first answer, though, is actually your initial point is not right, which is to say productivity and growth have continued to rise a lot, and they still
rise.
No, not true. It's the distribution of it that has changed. Well, we can go back and forth on this, but I mean, I can show you the data that we use. And even if it's slower, which as I say, actually it hasn't been, but even if we're slow, it is still rising. The problem is that the gains from it have all been captured by a very small group at the top. Right. So it's a distribution problem and not
So if people are responding that way, it's not that we can't actually do something to provide them with the thing that drove this, which is a sense that my life is flat and my children's lives are going to either be flat or worse, but we can address that problem directly. And hopefully in ways that are better. So everybody see, just if you see that point. So what we're looking at is a different, because the neoliberal paradigm is, that has been the downside. It's exactly what it has produced, is that kind of maldistribution of wealth, because the structure of it, which is to take out the democracy part of capitalism, that creates the situation for a better, what we call pre-distribution. Right? One of the part of the neoliberal answer has been, we structure markets in a way designed to maximize growth, and then after the fact, to the extent that there are issues, either market failures or bad distribution, we redistribute the wealth. Of course, most people don't like to redistribute. Right, it's like, wait, you said this is mine. You're going to take it away from me and give it to somebody else who didn't earn it. That doesn't feel right. So you can think of a world in which we're going to structure the markets differently at the front end so that they will produce a better distribution. And what we actually have a fair amount of data for is that will actually produce more growth than the free market paradigm, that this kind of wealth inequality is itself a lag on growth. So there are all sorts of solutions that we should be exploring before that, particularly since, to the extent that ethno-nationalism is an answer, as it is for some people, it's a really bad answer in the long run, also economically for them, right? Because the one thing that we're not going to get away from anymore is an interdependent world. So the only solution to, the only product of the nationalism stuff is going to be even less economic growth on the whole and wars. And so in the same way that communism and fascism had appeal for people as the laissez-faire paradigm.
But that's our concern.
So we can't accept it. That's what's driving us. We have to develop a better alternative, but we believe there's definitely room to do so. Now, the last point, which I just want to touch on, the new alternative in the long run is going to have to abandon something else that has been central, not just to neoliberalism, but really to Western economic thinking for a long time, which is that there's always room for more growth. I mean, one of the things the climate problem drives home, the biodiversity problem, of which climate itself is just a subset, is that there actually are limits on our resources. So we're going to have a paradigm that recognizes that there are those limits and think about how to work with them. And we just have to, we don't have an answer to that yet. It'll be part of the socialization. It has to be.
I'm just going to say a couple of things. There's a study at MIT called Work of the Future. I love that. David Autor is one of the heads. He's the labor economist. I insisted on calling it WTF just to irritate my colleagues. Work of the Future, David has written extensively about what Larry's referring to, which is the barbell effect, which is, you know, income going to the extremes, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, the middle class getting hollowed out. So that reports out. The other thing is, I was in India recently, and I was talking to someone in India about American sort of, you know, are you a patriot? You know, so the Fox News, are you a patriot? And this economist in India, his view was that if you look at the per capita consumption of resources around the world, like energy, water, etc., it's so lopsided. So if you're a politician in America and you're saying, let's make it more even-handed, you're actually taking resources away potentially from an American, and that's unpatriotic. So that's his view of why, that person actually is my father, but anyway, that's his view of why the word patriot appears a lot of times, because they're running into resource limitations and an equitable distribution disadvantages the hats. Mm-hmm. So anyway, just a quick thought.
It is, by the way, this is the different dimension of the technology problem that we didn't point out, which is the productivity, that's I just found this chart, which is, this is from 1984, has been largely a product of technology, which has hurt me.
So we had a question then, Nathan?
Yeah, so just tracking another, I guess, deeper paradigm and building, I think, on Claudio's point about ethno-nationalism. I was struck by the lack of mention of race and racism in the piece, and I think as we think about both locuses of where work that challenges the neoliberal paradigm are underway right now, I would hold up the work on anti-racism in the US as one of those places potentially, and that an original sin, I think, in Western thought is the racist myth and the idea that the way that it justifies exploitation of people. And I think it seems like if ethno-nationalism is the major countervailing alternative paradigm, it would be amiss to not go directly after one of the main premises of that paradigm, which is that racial and cultural differences actually mean anything of substance. So I'd just be curious, like, what's the plan to talk to folks on who are leading those anti-racist efforts? Yeah.
So you've touched on what for us tactically is the most difficult challenge. And I say tactically because we have no doubt that, you know, racism has been a core driver in the following sense, by the way. Part of the uptake on neoliberalism in the 60s in the US was a product for citizens who really wouldn't have cared about it, had been longstanding kind of Roosevelt Democrats. It justified keeping government from doing anything about race because they didn't want that to happen. So there's no question. There are people who take the position that neoliberalism was motivated by race, which, you know, clearly can't be true since all the ideas were developed in Europe in the 1920s and 30s, you know, and it's just not on people's mind, but that it has worked nicely for racists in lots of ways. So we have no question about that. And for what it's worth, a more recent draft that we'll be using does make some references to race because we realized we needed to have some. But from a tactical perspective, we have the following fact, and this is a problem not just in this strategy, we have this in a lot of strategies. Not the straight up, like our education strategies are straight up equity focused. So you can put that front and center because it really is the problem that we're trying to tackle. Here, we're not going to make progress. I was at a meeting yesterday in which basically you had a group of people saying the following thing. Like, we have this huge problem for democracy. This was a democracy meeting because a majority of the majority have lost faith and don't believe the government is trying to help them at all. And we have to solve that problem by dealing with racial exclusion. And I'm like, okay, the problem is that group that you're worried about that's undermining democracy already feel that the racial minorities have gotten too much attention. They feel like they've been ignored for the last 30 years. And so although you're right, racial exclusion is a huge problem, we have to deal with it. If you want to get these people to work with you on something, if you lead with that, you've lost them right out the door. And that's what I said, just a tactical problem. How do we talk about this? How do we find a way that we can sort of appeal across the various audiences that we need to listen and think and engage with us? And I'm trapped. I mean, we're trapped in our democracy work by, you know, on the one side, people who are like, unless you lead with race, you're not serious. And people who, if you lead with race, you're not serious. And we need them both. And I don't have an answer to that. We've struggled with every meeting we go to, we struggle about how to talk about race. In a way that keeps the middle right, at least, that's what we're looking at. Actually, weirdly enough, it's not middle or far right, because these ideas don't cut that way. It's actually quite a few people from the far right. They're the Trump-Sanders types, right, who are the really, you know, people who are feeling this and responding in different ways that we think are potentially movable. But how many of you have read Arlie Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land? Yeah. The really powerful thing, I found the book kind of annoying in lots of ways, but the really powerful, she has that image at the end of, like, totally captures, I think, the mindset, where she says, for those who haven't read it, imagine there's a hill and a city on the top of the hill, and that's the American dream, and there's this really long line to get into the city, and you're standing in the back of the line, playing by the rules that you need to get into that city to get the American dream. And there's people who are already in the city and they're standing on the walls of that city and they're jeering at you. And not only are they jeering at you, but they're letting all these other people cut in line. That's the mindset, which I thought that so captures it, right? So, and those people, that's why I don't think it's, for a lot of them, it's not fundamentally racism. Whoever was being allowed to, from their perspective, cut in line would be annoying to them, because they feel like they're standing there waiting. And again, this is not, I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but this is the worldview. And so if we don't sort of, we have to figure out how to work with that. And as I say, insisting that you're wrong, even if I think it, that those people should be allowed to cut in line because actually they were way farther back for no good reason in the first place or whatever, that's just tactically not gonna help us get anywhere. So we shied away from it and tried to focus on the things that we think are universal in the sense that they should cut across all these groups' concerns, but I don't think we're gonna be able to get away with that because, as I say, so many people, like, you have to name this, and they're not wrong. They're not wrong, they just, I don't know how to do it.
And there's this interesting tribal alliances now, but, you know, Modi, Trump is in India right now, or is about to go to India to visit Modi, Netanyahu, Trump. Sort of interesting triangulation of interests, right? United by certain phobias.
Yeah.
I would just offer that I think I hear that concern, and I think tactically it's deeply problematic. I also think the same step you're making by stepping up from questions of evidence on policy to paradigms on politics, making that move on some of these questions on racism, actually trying to take on the paradigms that support the idea that the racist differences are real. Not saying
no question,
change policy on racial exclusion, actually say, let's make sure that when we're talking about a new paradigm, we are encompassing those paradigms, those premises that support racial exclusion.
Yes, no question. Yes.
So my real question is, could we do this every Thursday morning? but in your, you write and you fund and you teach, and in this paper, it seems like there's reference to December meeting and a January meeting. You're organizing too. Can you say a word more about that organizing work and who the like-minded philanthropies and the organizations that you're bringing together and what the plan is for that?
Sure. Well, so that's along a lot of dimensions, and I should say most of the credit for this should go to Jennifer Harris, who is the senior fellow here, who has been actually doing the work. And if you ever get a chance to know her, she's like a genius and also really, really good at this and like knows everybody in the universe, even though she's, I think, in her late 30s or early 40s. Anyway, we've been organizing in different places. So first, in some ways, the easiest was organizing think tanks, because there were a number of think tanks that were interested in the set of issues. And with them, it was mostly a question of raising their sights and ambition from the immediate policy solutions that they were pushing to think about this deeper, broader question. And a lot of think tanks weren't interested in doing that, but a number were. The key ones from our perspective, the Roosevelt Institute, the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, I forget, there's about 6 or 7 of them, and we organized them as a table, and they're working together. We're working on movement groups right now. I don't actually, there's a forthcoming meeting, so I'm not sure exactly who they are, but getting them also. What's been interesting in the conversations that we've had with movement leaders, which makes me feel really good, because most of our funders, when we talk about ideas, are like, we don't need, say, universities. We don't need educators for ideas. The movement people are every bit as capable of generating ideas. Is they will say to us, we're not this kind of ideas. We actually need and want support from these other sectors. And so we're going to try and get them to talk to some of the funders. So the funders are the groups that are talked about in that memo, because it's a memo to the board. And one of the things we have to explain is really, we're not going to be doing this alone, because it would be impossible to do alone. And, you know, there's a set of obvious suspects, which, you know, Ford, Open Society, who else? Weiss, you know, the sort of overtly lefty with clear economic interests funders. And then what's been interesting, our major partners so far actually emerged as the Omidyar Network. And that's chiefly because when Matt Banach stepped down, Pierre hired a guy named Mike Kubzansky and said to him, I think I want to be working on sort of deeper, broader issues than we have been. And Mike was interested in this set of issues before I ever talked to him. And then he read my thing and I read. And so they're really good partners on this, because they're interested in it in exactly the same way we are. With most of the other funders, it's about 13 or 14 so far. There's some European funders, the Oak Foundation, Marisla, KR, CIF, Children's Investment Fund Foundation, those are the Europeans. With most of the, as I said, the funders, we have that problem where it's kind of like your point, which is they're interested in the work down here and not, they're just not interested in this stuff. So that's not what you were saying, but they're not interested in this stuff. I mean, I had, you know, Darren Walker said to me, we already know what we need to do. We're impatient to do it. And I'm like, I understand that, but if you want to do it effectively, you need, this is action. So these meetings are really trying to help restore, because it's restore. Funders, the conservative funder story we know, liberal funders in the 40s and 50s, up through the 60s, did exactly the same thing. The Ford Foundation, more than anybody else, invested in ideas. And the reason there was so much progress made was because the background set of ideas in that period were the liberal set, was the Keynesian set of ideas, which had been very much funded. You know, they weren't created in quite the same way, but they were supported and pushed. And when they became so well established, liberal funders drifted away from caring about that, and they haven't come back. What's interesting is conservative funders have drifted away from that. So with the exception of the Charles Koch Foundation, conservative funders fund the same way the liberals do now, which is projects, you know, for specific things. They've really lost that sense of building an intellectual infrastructure within which all your ideas move more easily. Okay.
So Larry, you talked about how one of the problems of neoliberalism is the inequitable distribution of wealth. We have growth, but it's going increasingly to a small percentage of people. And you also said once somebody has the wealth, it's difficult to get them to redistribute it voluntarily. And you said you just had breakfast with Lessig the other day. I'm guessing that part of the discussion was around Lessig's current work around money can buy and in fact pre-select politicians, which then pre-selects the elections, and then you get the policies that those. So essentially, the wealthy that are getting this money can buy the politics and therefore buy what the governments are doing, oftentimes to reinforce and support the wealth mechanisms and distribution that brings them even more wealth, right? And so Larry is always fond of saying, your project matters, but my project comes first.
Yeah.
Because until we solve this problem, it's difficult to solve climate change or anything else because you're not going to get the policies that you're going to want. And so, if all that's true, can you move paradigms with that kind of capitalistic distribution of wealth system in place? Can you move paradigms without governments?
Yeah. So the problem I've always had with Larry on this issue is our society actually isn't Florence in the medieval ages. There's not a wealth class that actually stands distinct from the masses, where the masses want one set of policies that they can't get because the wealthy support them. The fact of the matter is there is as much or more support for that set of policies in the people. You know, that's why you always say, the people in Kansas, it's not that they're being deluded by campaign spending. It's just that's so insulting. Again, one of the nice things if you read Arlie's book is they buy this idea set. They embrace it. They believe it. And at the same time, there are plenty of billionaires on the left. But they're only pushing for the kinds of redistribution policies that are part of the same paradigm. So I don't think it's a wealth-poor thing. It's an ideas framework that's shared by wealthy and poor, within which there is a left-to-right distribution. There's progressive neoliberals and conservative neoliberals, but they're all neoliberals. And we don't have an idea set that's in the alternative. Now, there are a whole other bunch of problems. By the way, the problem of money in politics is absolutely a problem, but that's not the problem. Right? And, the problem is things like candidates have to spend 50 or 60% of their time trolling for dollars, which means they don't have time to do their own work, which means they're subject to lobbyists telling them what they can and can't do and so on. So it's not that rich people have befuddled the rest of society into adopting a set of policies that rich people like that other people don't. And then, it's just, as I say, there is a successful conservative movement that consists of millions and millions of not rich people who believe it. And that's what we have to change.
A quick note on the Hochschilds, the couple, I think I've forgotten the husband's name, he's a historian, wrote a book on King Leopold. They are a 300-year-old mining company that basically gave all their money away. And so, what it's worth, they are, I think, have a lot of, they're completely committed, shall we say.
Yeah, although I will say, one of the really distressing things, you all know the Gates Pledge, right?
Yeah.
There's like 204 of those people that, like, they're not giving anything away. They're earning 9% and they're giving away like 0.1% of their wealth every year. It's like, yeah, I'm going to do it tomorrow.
No, but these guys are.
Yeah, but they're they are the exception.
So what we should probably do is it's about 10:25. We should go to Fran's encore showing. I just want to make a quick comment. I was flying back a few years ago after the foot and mouth disease. That's three pandemics ago. from England.
Mad cow?
I think it was foot and mouth.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah, something like that. One of those diseases. And England had just been through this. Actually, the UK had been through a massive sheep cull. They cull up all the sheep. And I stand, and the guy's
flying with me is actually a farmer, sort of a, and but he'd come from a farming family. And he, so I said, how's it going? And he said, oh, you know, it's not the sheep. We can buy the sheep. We can buy the sheep from Europe. There are government grants. But we have a more serious problem. And I said, what is it? So this is what he told me. And I promise you this is relevant to our conversation. Okay, so I think it's a great story. In England, especially in England and Scotland, the sheep feed, they graze on in the commons, right? Like the Boston Commons, the commons. But over the generations, the sheep know which side of the commons belong to which flock. And they behave themselves. And the sheepdog sort of, you know, manage them. And they pass it on from generation to generation. So the flock will sort of, you know, teach its new generation. The problem with the cull was that sheep knowledge was gone. So you got these new sheep in, and they had no clue which side of the commons was theirs. They would mix, they would, you know, you never knew which was going to go where. They had no sheepdog culture, right? It was chaos. Why do I say this? I think the idea of commons and, you know, sort of a tide that lifts all boat, I think it's a cultural thing. And part of the issue for us right now is as we privatize the commons, we're going to lose our culture of the commons. And I think that's a little bit existential, you know. So with that thought, thank you, Larry, thanks for hosting us. Thank you again to Angela and to Peter and to Kurt for organizing. Thank you all. And we will go to Fran's movie. Okay.